Hello and welcome to a Saturday special of Coffee House Shots. I'm Kate Andrews, and today's podcast doesn't come to you from our offices in Westminster, but instead from a cafe in the heart of Stockholm. I'm looking around me, and there are no masks in sight. The shops are open, people are walking in, picking up items, putting them down, and nothing seems to be quarantined because of this. I dare say it feels a lot like normal. Now, of course, things aren't completely normal in Sweden. The country was hit by the pandemic, as every country was, but it has been handled remarkably differently. Sitting across from me is author and historian Johan Norberg, who's just published his most recent book, Open, The Story of Human Progress. Johan, thanks for joining me. This podcast is a little bit different for me because, first of all, we're together in the same place. We're inside enjoying a coffee at a cafe. We're fairly socially distanced, but we haven't properly measured it. And this circumstance in the UK at the moment would be illegal. We couldn't be doing this mixing between households indoors. So this is a very strange experience for me. But you...
I'll guide you through it.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Take it slow. You live in Sweden, so this isn't strange for you. You've been having coffees.
Yeah, this is how we've lived the past 6 months. So to us, the surprising thing is that the rest of the world has chosen a completely different path.
It must be strange with the world's eyes on Sweden in particular, because you have been the outlier in the way that Sweden has handled COVID-19. Do you think there are any regrets?
Well, it is controversial in Sweden as well. But the first thing we've noticed is that we've caught the attention of everybody else. And that's always flattering for a small country in a way, but it's also always a little bit scary to be the odd man out. If you make a major mistake, you want to make the same mistake as everybody else rather than doing something differently.
Even if that mistake is a grave mistake.
Yes, yeah. And that is my conclusion so far. It seems to be the conclusion of most Swedes as well. Trust in the public health authority and in the Swedish government has surged, it skyrocketed during the pandemic. And what was said all the time from Swedes during the first wave of the pandemic is that no country is going to escape this. The only thing you can do is delay cases and the transmission of disease in other places, but at a huge cost to not just the economy, but to society, the societal fabric, mental health, domestic abuse, the cost of kids who miss out on school, all those things. And that seems to be what we're seeing right now. Sweden, we continue to act normally, but you and it seems everybody else is going back into lockdowns, and we have no idea when and even what normal is for the rest of Europe.
It does seem to be going in that direction in the UK. We're getting new rule after new rule, much stricter measures coming in France and Spain as well. But your top epidemiologists, your public health officials have said, we're not really going to know who got it right or wrong for years when it comes to COVID-19. But you've hinted at it there. We will know much sooner the implications of lockdown, what's happened to non-COVID patients, what's happened to those children who weren't able to go to school potentially indoors and not very nice circumstances in their households. Do you think that in Sweden that's being recognized elsewhere, seeing the devastation that's been wrought from going into lockdown?
Absolutely. I think that's the difference between Sweden and other places, I think, is that Sweden and our authorities stuck to the script. Basically, when most, at least liberal democracies, wargamed a pandemic, the Swedish version, the Swedish model, was what everybody, or at least most experts and politicians, agreed upon, because they saw the long-term consequences, the alternative costs of going down into drastic, radical lockdowns. The thing that changed was that all the other countries suddenly lost faith in what they had thought about when they took a sort of a cold calculation of costs and benefits long-term. And when everybody else started to change their minds. And this is something that we've seen when we look at when and how and why did countries go into lockdowns. It wasn't based on any cost-benefit analysis. It wasn't dependent on the state of their health care at that point in time or the transmission. It was based on what did the neighbors do. So it was really just herd mentality in a way. And I think, and when I listen to specifically health authorities in other countries, they begin to regret this now when they're beginning to see the cost the other costs to people who didn't get COVID but lost out due to lockdowns.
It was thought at the start of the virus in the UK that the UK might go the same way as Sweden. And then, as you say, that changed rather dramatically. Of course, your neighbours in Denmark, who I believe are threatening to lock you out again, would point to Sweden's higher death rate when it comes to COVID-19 and say, well, on that metric, it's completely failed. So do you think Sweden's been more honest about the very difficult trade-offs that have to be made? Or do you think that they're still optimistic that at the end of all this, even on the death rate, Sweden could actually look quite decent compared to other countries?
I think Sweden has been a bit more honest about the trade-offs. We know that there are costs associated with any choice we make, and to some extent we're all flying blind here. But everybody else got so completely focused on COVID-19, and then the immediate costs and cases and deaths, for obvious reasons, but then they just assumed away everything that's going to happen long term. When it comes to the Swedish analysis of, so what is the cost? I think that one difference was that a country like Britain got so scared by some early modelling based on also so many unknowns that it was almost completely useless, that just seeing that printed in newspapers, the TV and radio, it was just so scary that you had to show that you did something about it. We had the same kind of models in Sweden as well, saying that we'd face 90,000 or 100,000 deaths by now if we didn't go into the same kind of lockdown as Britain did. And that was off by some almost 95,000 deaths in Sweden. So it tells you that we're all guessing to some extent, but when you're guessing, perhaps you should adhere to a more rational version of the precautionary principle. The one thing we do know is that it's associated with terrible health and social costs to people, to shut down societies and force people to stay at home and not going to school and not being able to go to work and associate.
Do you know if there's been any collapse in the healthcare that's been delivered to non-COVID patients in Sweden?
We had lots of voluntary social distancing in Sweden. When you look at mobility data from March, April, May, it was fairly similar to other Nordic countries, but on a voluntary basis. People stayed at home and they didn't go to cafes like this for a very long time, and they didn't go to hospitals because they didn't want to catch COVID-19, for example. But what happened then was that our authorities really recommended people don't stay away from hospitals. If you need care, if you need attention, you should go. We have the capacity, and that's better in terms of costs and benefits than staying home afraid. So we've had more of cancer screening, we've had more of the usual routine work in healthcare than many other countries.
Some say, you spoke to the voluntary nature of Sweden's pseudo-lockdown. Some say that other countries just simply couldn't have done this, that the behavior in Sweden lended itself to a voluntary lockdown, but that countries like the UK or the US had to be shut down. Just far too unruly to be so thoughtful about these things. Do you agree with that? Do you think Sweden is the outlier in the world because there's something unique about the nation? Or was this just a lack of trust in humanity and in people in a difficult situation to do the right thing, regardless of where they were?
Well, I think you would have to make that judgment. I hesitate to talk about the national identity of other countries, whether they're as responsible as Swedes are. I think the funny thing about this is that lots of people, including many Swedes, are very surprised that Sweden chose this path and would have said that, no, that's not our tradition. Our tradition is to have a very nosy nanny state telling us exactly what first places like Britain and the US, you have more of an individualist tradition, and you would take responsibility for this yourself instead. I think if we had done it completely the other way around, with forced social distancing in Sweden, not in Britain, people would have said, yeah, but that only works in Britain because you have a tradition of not having policemen sort of looking into your business and assume individual responsibility, whereas Swedes have to be told what to do from the government. So I think it's so easy post event to come up with these explanations. I'm not sure if they're accurate. There is something to the interpersonal trust in Sweden, I think. To many small, fairly homogenous countries like Sweden, where we have more trust in our neighbors and in our governments, potentially, when they're telling us to do something, more or less we assume that they do it because they're not bad people. So perhaps there's something to that. But I also think that when you get those responsibilities and when you're not harassed by the government, by police, you tend to grow with that responsibility as well. And that's what I've heard from lots of Swedes as well. Look, now we've got to behave because this is now our choice. Whereas in other countries where you've been told what to do, there's much more than I see protests and anger and embitterment with these choices. And that's one reason why it might not be as sustainable in the long run with having a very strong, forceful response to the pandemic.
You mentioned the nanny state. I came on this little trip to Stockholm seeking a little flavor of freedom. And in many ways, I feel like I've gotten it. But then you're reminded, especially pre-pandemic, that the social democracy is quite strict in many ways. I mean, you can't buy a bottle of wine on a Saturday evening. And if you do want to buy one at all, you have to do it from a state-sanctioned shop. So a reminder that we can't only look at freedom in the context of COVID-19. There are many other issues. But I wanted to touch on your first book, Progress, before we get to your latest and fantastic book, Open, because Progress made the very optimistic case that things are getting better and better. If I remember correctly, it opens with a line that suggests that by the time you finish reading this chapter, thousands of people will have risen out of absolute poverty. And it's a book about how, despite what the doomsayers say, things are getting better by the day. That may not be true in 2020. Compared to 2019, poverty is very likely to rise, potentially by millions, if not tens or hundreds of millions of people. Diseases like malaria and tuberculosis that we were getting more and more under control, that we had treatments and vaccines for, are going to be on the rise because people haven't gotten access to their medication. How do you react to this, being such the optimist?
Yeah. Well, I've always said that I'm a qualified rational optimist, not the kind, the automatic default optimist.
It's a very specific type of optimist. Yes.
Yeah, it's the kind of optimism that says, it'll be fine if you do what I say. Mm-hmm. It's not the default automatic version of things will just be fine. Well, yeah, but sort of the Swedish voluntary recommendations. It's not automatic, and that's why I write my books. If I thought that everything will just be fine, I wouldn't have to do anything about it. I could just do something else. What I say is that if we have the freedom to explore new knowledge, experiment with it in new business models and technologies and exchanges across borders with trade and free markets, then all will be fine. Eventually, we'll solve more problems every day than we create. And in the long run, that makes the difference between a lifespan of 30 years and one over 80. But if that breaks down, if you undermine those institutions, if you don't allow people to go to work in the morning and work hard and come up with new ideas and exchange the results with their neighbors, then things will be bad. And that's why I think that this pandemic is really a full-scale, real-life test for what a non-globalized, non-free market world looks like. Because this is exactly what they wanted, the kind of, you know, a bizarre combination of Steve Bannon and Greta Thunberg. No one is moving, flying, no one is trading, migrating. And this is the result. We'll see an increase in extreme poverty by 50 to 100 million this year. But latest calculations say that perhaps 1 million children will die just because of this pandemic, not of COVID-19, but of the lockdowns. And that's what happens if we do not have freedom, making the world safe for progress. So that makes me obviously very worried about the world potential long-term effects, if we'll stay in this new normal for a long time, if there are pushes for more self-sufficiency, more authoritarianism in the long run. There is a risk that more things will be permanent than we wish. There's nothing as permanent as a temporary government program, as Milton Friedman pointed out. But with all that said, I am still an optimist in this way, that if I had to pick one year in human history when to face a pandemic, if I had to face one, it would be 2020, because we've never had the kind of wealth, the kind of technologies, the cooperation across borders between scientists and drug manufacturers, vaccine companies, and so on, as we've had today. This is the best place to stay safe from a pandemic like this. It would have brought a much, much greater human toll in any other year in human history.
It is incredible what the anti-inflammatory treatments that we've managed to use on COVID-19 patients have already done to bring down the death toll in a matter of months. So that point is very well taken, Johan, and I'm certainly inclined to agree with you that as horrible as it has been, it has also been a very clear case study of the world that we could live in if we stopped trade, if we stopped the free flow of goods and services and people. And yet, those arguments still gain traction. I mean, I don't know what it's like here in Sweden, but certainly in the UK, all of the talk is how we completely change society. This is our moment to go on a brand new course. This is our moment, really. It often ends up with the end point being to bring in more state, more interference, to curb the market more. People seem to like these ideas despite what we've just witnessed.
Yeah, it's a little bit scary to see the enthusiasm of many public intellectuals and politicians when they say, ha, you said it couldn't be done, but look, we can do anything. We can impose curfews, we can stop people from flying, we can block trade.
Isn't people often say, they poll saying, we'd like some more, please.
Yes, and that really brings me to my latest book, Open the Story of Human Progress, where I point out that we've had many efflorescences in human history, many golden eras, many cultures who've had a rapid period of innovation, of economic productivity, increase in scientific knowledge and so on. But they were, all of them, brought to an end, except this one so far. We'll see what happens. But they were brought to an end almost always because of this fear of various crises. Could be a Great Depression, natural disaster, foreign threats, or pandemics historically, because that's the period in time when we, all of us, enter this kind of collective fight or flight instinct, when we just want to pick a fight with someone, foreigners, the rich, minorities, other scapegoats for our problems, or hide behind trade barriers and walls to get some sort of protection from strong men and from big governments. And that's the greatest risk, that kind of fear, because when we fear, when we're afraid, we panic. We don't make rational cost-benefit choices long-term for our health and our wealth, our opportunities long-term. We just want safety. And we tend to think that safety comes from big men with guns, comes from our chiefs, our tribes, our collectives, our governments. And it seems like we're in such a panic-stricken period right now.
As I've been reading Open, it has a lot of the optimism of progress, but I would say that there's a bit of an edge to it. It seems to follow on from progress, noting that things are getting better, but then it asks, why are we so often intent on ruining this prosperous world that we've created? Do you think there's a clear and distinct answer to that question as to why we tend to throw it all away?
Well, I think it's a mismatch between our brains and the worlds our brains have created. And, I mean, we can see that everywhere. Look at this cafe and all the wonderful cakes they've got here. Our Stone Age brains, we crave it. We want it because we used to be lacking in fat and sugar. Now we've created a world of surplus, and then we'll have to try to deal with that in another way. And it's the same thing with the fear that we used to have of others, of uncertainty, of an uncertain future, of historically, because that's, we always lived on the verge of disaster, of starvation, and of the end, basically. So we've learned, our minds, our brains have learned to be constantly on the lookout for that fear and to hide behind a kind of a tribe, a collective, some big man who tells us what to do when things get scary. We're not used to seeing the solution to our problem coming from a strange, eccentric inventor in a garage, or on the other side of the planet, reading the genome of a virus and coming up with a vaccine. Those are things that we have to learn to understand intellectually and through understanding history and economics, these things. It's not what our sort of reptilian brains tell us. They tell us, it's scary, we want protection right now, and everybody else seems scary right now. And I think that mismatch explains this constant craving for safety and protection, rather than trying to understand that solutions to problems nowadays comes from uncertainty, opening up as many opportunities as possible for as many people as possible to experiment and to innovate ourselves out of this.
This book covers everything from the origins of modern society to the big tech companies, but I couldn't help but think when I picked up the book and when reading it that the title, Open, may have specifically been putting reference towards immigration. Immigrants made up 24% of bachelor's degrees and 47% of doctorates in American science and engineering in the 2000 census, even though they only made up 12% of the workforce. I mean, you reference over and over again the benefits that migrants can bring when they come to a new place. And I imagine before COVID-19 hit, when you were working on this book the majority of the time, immigration must have been like the United States have changed so dramatically in such a short period of time.
Yeah, it really changed dramatically, rapidly. But there is a historical precedent for that as well. We've often seen that in times of economic crisis, specifically in financial crisis, we have seen this fear of immigrant groups that we used to think were hardworking, contributing members of our society. Suddenly they are the problem. They are taking our jobs or our welfare payments or what have you. And that's, I think, because we start to think in times of an economic crisis that the world and the economy is a zero-sum game, because the cake is actually shrinking at that time. That's bad. It's not. A free market is a system where we create new wealth. A new no deal, no hiring of a new worker ever happens without both parties thinking that they benefit from it. But that's, again, something new. We've only lived in that kind of society for a very short period of time. Historically, we didn't have rapid economic growth that made a major difference during our lifespans. We didn't see rapid innovations. We didn't see many doctoral degrees. So if someone else got much richer and had much more than we did, he probably took it from us. Took our land, took our resources, and therefore we're always a little bit suspicious about the other groups or someone who is better off than we are, because we have that evolutionary tendency. And during a financial crisis, and this is really the 2007-2008 crisis, I think, that got this started, made most of us think, again, that it's a zero-sum game, and therefore anyone who makes advances probably does it by taking the bread out of our mouths. And then we began to look around at who are the others in our society. And that was different. You just took what you had at hand. So in the US, suddenly Mexicans was seen as much more suspicious than they used to. In Sweden, Muslim immigrants. In Eastern Europe, not many refugees, but a history of anti-Semitism, for example. In Britain, Eastern European workers. Didn't really matter. You take what you have at hand, but you begin to think of us and them and forget about economics and the mutual benefit of a free market again. So you're absolutely right. That's one of the reasons why I wrote this, trying to tell our reptilian brains to look at economics, look at history, and look at the long term. Because the problem with thinking that the world is a zero-sum game is that we often turn it into a zero-sum or even a minus-sum game, because we create those fights and those conflicts that really undermines our open society.
Many of the people who read your books, many of the people who will be following what you write, who consider themselves to be free market, to be perhaps small or even large seat conservative, have been swept away with a lot of the rhetoric that, say, comes from the President of the United States, that these, in recent history anyway, these parties that focused on free markets and even on free movement have turned away from the latter. Do you find more hostility when you present these arguments now than you did maybe?
In a way, there's some strange political realignment going on, and I think it's too early to tell where it's going to end up, because lots of people who, as you say, used to believe in free markets suddenly begin to believe in, you know, some sort of new version of Stalin's socialism in one country. Now it's free markets in one country. We can do it within our borders. But let's not have too many migrants, not too much trade, outsourcing, things like that. And then you suddenly see that people on the right who used to agree with me are suddenly very hostile when the arguments about mutual benefit and plus-sum games crosses a border. They think it's quite okay within Sweden, but then it gets scarier. On the other hand, there are people who didn't used to agree with me in the center and on the left even, who begin to be more open-minded, I think, to free market arguments. It might just be a sort of an anti-Donald Trump phenomena. If Trump doesn't like free trade, then there's got to be something good about it. But there's something going on there, partly because many center-right and right-wing parties have started to get a larger vote share from traditionally market-skeptical working-class voters. And that has an effect long-term on your policies as well. If you start to, instead of trying to encourage them with the right arguments, allowing them to change what you are instead.
You go through several revolts against openness, as you call it in the book, from the Mongols of Russia to Adolf Hitler. But you also note that every generation prefers individual autonomy over authority more than the last. And again, that keeps you optimistic that perhaps there will be fewer and fewer revolts against openness going forward. Do you broadly stick by that, or do you think that COVID-19, this political realignment that you just spoke of, is unfortunately going to throw that theory up into the air?
Well, we can't take anything for granted. It's true when we look at the broad values in society, it seems like every generation over the last 100 years have expressed more belief in individual autonomy than in authority. And it's not just a age effect. At the same age, every generation has been more than sort of open-minded, liberal in a broad sense, than the previous generation at that age. But on the other hand, what history teaches us is that these revolts against openness and the openness to strongmen, it can suddenly appear almost out of nowhere, as long as we just panic, as long as we get sufficiently scared about the world, this might happen. And it often happens because an older generation is afraid of what the younger generation is doing to society, and then they support an authoritarian revolt. But sometimes it's the young generation seeing what they think is a new dangerous threat, and they want to shut down society because of that. For example, attitudes to the environment. We have many more environmentalists in a younger generation, and often they don't think that the solution comes from green technology and new innovations. They think the right response is to shut down societies, stop flying and stop moving about and trading with other places. And so that kind of temptation is there in every generation. Nothing is a certainty.
Johan, you referenced the lessons of history. To wrap up this podcast, what lessons can the rest of the world learn from Sweden in terms of COVID-19, but perhaps related to other forms of public policy? Hopefully not nanny state lessons, as we mentioned before. But if this is an opportunity to export things that Sweden gets right, what would you say those things are?
Well, I think the major lesson from Sweden is that human beings are a bit underrated, especially in the eyes of bureaucrats and politicians, when they think that we now have one societal goal, we've got to slow down the transmission, for example, then they tend to think that they have a chessboard and they are just supposed to move the pieces on the board to the right place. Well, it seems like Swedes, given the option, given the freedom, they move to fairly accurate places on the chessboard out of their own free will. And they did it. They slowed down mobility, but it also gave some room for individual needs and for local knowledge. So if you really had to go there to your job, or you really have to meet your dying parent, if you really had to meet someone to keep a romantic relationship going, you could do that. That's the kind of things that no planner can ever foresee and decide one size fits all. And that, I think, created more of support for these policies in Sweden as well, so that perhaps these policies are bit more sustainable in Sweden than in other places. So I think that's the lesson that Sweden has to offer the world. When given some responsibility, people take it. But when you treat people like children, they're going to start behaving like children as well.
Johan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Maskless and all.
Brave of you to come to Sweden.
Very delighted to be here.